Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Coming up on this week's show, the GTA Trilogy reboot reviews are in and they're not good.
Duke Nukem gets the craziest spin-off we've ever seen.
And we talk Agony, Unreal and Outcast with Frank Sauer.
The Retro Owl podcast is brought to you each week with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, just available again on their website from this week, the guide to Japanese role-playing games, covering the entire history of JRPG games from 1982 to 2020. This is their most ambitious book to date, reviewing over 600 games and coming in at over 650 pages. You can check that out on the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.co.uk. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 302, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast that every Friday takes you behind the scenes on classic video games. A nice healthy dollop of nostalgia on each week's show as well. And also we talk about new stuff that's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology. Because that's the thing about this show. Obviously, we reminisce a lot, but it's not all about stuff that happened 20, 30 years ago. Because it is a legit subgenre of gaming now, retro. And in fact, we've seen so many re-releases of classic games. Of course, a big one that we need to talk about in just a minute is the Grand Theft Auto trilogy that we've been hyped about on this show for how long?
Oh god, years, because Ravi's been following it for absolutely years as well, haven't you, mate? So
yeah. And I think you're right, you know, a lot of titles are kind of, they're looking back, aren't they? And they're kind of running out of ideas, maybe.
I was gonna say, it's like Hollywood, they're running out of ideas, so they gotta go back.
But it turns out, I mean, something that you think would be the simplest thing to do ever, you know, get a 20-year-old game up and run and get it looking nice again. Turns out it may be a little bit more challenging than we anticipated. So we'll talk about the reviews that have come in for the trilogy. I've been playing a bit of it as well, so we'll talk more about that in just a moment. And of course, we do reminisce about games that we played as kids on this show as well. I mean, that was the original idea of this podcast when we thought about it 6 years ago. We want to find out the stories of consoles, of computers, of companies, of games that we grew up playing and kind of get the real stories from the horse's mouth, as it were, you know, from the developer. And I remember playing a game called Agony when I was a kid. Now, to me, this must have been around 1991 when I first saw that game. And I remember at the time I still had a Commodore Plus 4, which was, you know, a very low-powered 8-bit home computer. And I saw this game called Agony that had this incredible graphic. It was like a side-scrolling shoot-em-up game of an owl over a parallax-scrolling background. It had, like, rain and thunder and lightning effects, and it had this gorgeous piano music on it as well. It was like something from another world.
When I first saw that game with the beautiful piano intro and stuff, I was nearly brought to tears. I was like, I'm an Amiga guy, and this is really, really showing the machine off. It was absolutely beautiful, and like the art behind it had some really famous people involved with there as well. Roger Dean, who did those fantastic, amazing covers. And, you know, we're talking to Frank Sauer today, and he was actually the co-founder of Art Magic, who were the developers that created this. And he's got a really interesting story, actually, because he worked on Agony as well, which was another amazing title, and Outcast, but also some C64 titles before that, like Iron Lord. He worked on Amstrad as well. And he was from the Belgium, and also he was working with France. So we've had a lot of developers on that have been from America, or they've been on from England and stuff, but we've not really covered that kind of European area that much. We've had a lot of German and stuff, but Belgium and France, I think this is really interesting, and it's a total different episode to ones that we usually have. But of course, it's got some good Commodore and Amiga content in there,
which we always love.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, you know, the companies you worked with back then, you know, Psygnosis, absolutely legendary companies, particularly for their graphics as well. I mean, they always had that it oozed quality. You could always tell a Psygnosis game, I think, couldn't you?
Oh, totally. And also Ubisoft, that apparently they all lived in a giant castle in a forest and developed in there, which sounds kind of crazy. So we've got some fun stories from those times as well.
So Frank Sauer, our special guest, he'll be coming up on the show in around 25 minutes from now. Now, just quickly before we jump into the news stories this week, lots to get through, including this absolutely insane new version of Duke Nukem 3D that we need to talk about in a second. Let's take a moment to give a big thank you to one of our regular sponsors. It is our wonderful mates at Retro Gamer Magazine. Now, Retro Gamer, of course, the monthly magazine that comes out covering all aspects of retro gaming. If you love our podcast, you should be reading it every month. And I mean, in the current issue, it is a celebration of Super Monkey Ball that has been going now for 20 years since that original game came out. I know you guys were big fans back in the day.
That just makes me feel really old, because I always used to play Super Monkey Ball at my friend's house on the GameCube after school, and absolutely loved the mini games in it because I was really, really bad at the main game. But that's amazing that they've got like the full history of it there, because there's so many games in that series as well.
Monkey bowling, mate.
Yeah, it's all about monkey bowling and the monkey parachuting.
And they've also got the making of a theme park as well. I mean, I remember first getting that game on a magazine cover disc and just being absolutely hooked on that. I did some really evil things, actually, thinking back. I was quite a twisted kid, you know, really treating the patrons of the park quite badly, actually, thinking back. But also the stuff in there, like, you know, Mega CD collection guide as well. A little in-depth guide on the Sega Nomad that was, you know, their 16-bit handheld console. And they also do a special feature on here as well, looking back on Christmases back in the day as well. A lot of Christmas memories. Now we're getting into that time of year. So, of course, you should be reading Retro Gamer Magazine every month. And actually, if you want to take up a subscription, there is an amazing offer that we've got for you right now, where you can get a free N64 Tribute or a Mega Drive Bluetooth controller. Now, you're probably going to be torn here, Joe. Which is your favourite out of those two, then?
This is so hard, because of the Mega Drive controller is the really kick-ass six-button controller, which I absolutely love. But then the N64 Tribute controller is the really, really nice two-prong controller, which we all begged for back in the 90s, which just didn't exist back then. So this is really difficult. But if I had to pick, I'd probably go for the N64 one, because I've not got any like that.
And you can use that on your original console as well. So you can get a USB or a classic N64 version, which is insane.
Yeah, and the Mega Drive one, that's a Bluetooth one. It works with you know, your emulators, Windows, Mac, Raspberry Pi, iOS, even on the Switch as well. Obviously, you've got a lot, you know, Mega Drive and N64 games on the Nintendo Switch now as well. Be perfect for those. So if you want to get hold of Retro Gamer Magazine, why don't you use our exclusive link, get yourself one of those incredible free retro controllers by heading to this website. Open a new tab in your browser right now. Go to magazinesdirect.com/retropod. And maybe you're already a Retro Gamer subscriber. You could gift the mag to someone else. You know, it's the season of goodwill is coming up, and keep the gift for yourself. You know, they're never going to know. And you'll get 6 months of Retro Gamer and that retro controller absolutely free. And of course, be helping out the podcast by doing it. Head to this website, magazinesdirect.com/retropod. And a big thank you to our friends at Retro Gamer for their support of our show. Right, then, we're going to get into it then. GTA Trilogy. Have you guys played it? Let's start at the beginning. Have you guys actually played any of the new versions then of three classic games
that
have now been re-released?
I've not wasted my money on that.
This is going to sound so harsh. So I have Xbox Game Pass, and San Andreas was on there, which I thought was really cool because of the original San Andreas, like, you know, the whatever you want to call it, HD remaster. I don't even know what you want to call it, but you know, the version that's been removed now, that was on there for like years, and I never played it. Like, I've played GTA to death, like so many other games I could play on there, and they've replaced it with the new, you know, remaster, which is really cool. And I downloaded it the other night, and then I've just seen, I don't even know what to call it without swearing. I've just seen, you know, the backlash of it all and how bad it is. So I've just deleted it. I've not played it.
I think it's good that it's on Game Pass, though, because that gives more accessibility to people. But let's talk about it, because, you know, the thing is, I love Rockstar, and I don't want it to be bad, and I don't want them to have a bad release, because they've got, like, their history is good releases and good quality games, and that's what they've always kind of gone on. But this seems like it's got so many problems that I don't know. They might be entering this kind of world, this modern world of release a game and then patch it later, which seems to be happening with so many releases at the moment, Cyberpunk being a great example. But I even remember like Assassin's Creed Black Flag that long ago, even longer than that, you know, there's been so many releases that are just broken at the start, and hearing so many elements of this game being broken is quite upsetting as a bit of a GTA fan, to be honest.
But you know what though, because that initial release is so important, because that is when all the magazine reviews come out, the website reviews, the YouTube videos are made.
People are streaming it.
Yeah, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression.
You've hit the nail on the head there. And my concern is, obviously, it came out on the 7th, so a week ago now, on all the, you know, the online stores and stuff. And then there's a physical release. Sorry, it came out on the 11th, sorry, of November. There's a physical release coming on the 7th of December, which is just like, is that enough time to fix it? You know, and like you say, like, you miss your first chance with games sometimes. Like you say, reviewers and everything like that. You know, it reminds me of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, not the remake of 1 and 2, but the one before that. I think it was Pro Skater 5, I can't remember, where it was just like an unplayable mess. And then they tried to fix it and made it relatively playable. But that still goes down as like one of the worst games ever made. And
well,
it's really...
look at Duke Nukem Forever, you know, that was complete...
Yeah, exactly. But it's so sad because it's like, have you guys seen its Metacritic score? It's like 0.5.
Yeah, well, the Switch version.
Yeah,
it's been hammered. I think one thing we'll just mention before we get into the meat of it is that, like, even with everything fixed, they're still missing, like, I think it's about 50 tunes.
Oh, yeah, and I thought that's what we were going to talk about when we...
Well, we said that the other week, didn't we? When we were talking about whether it was going to be good or not, we said if that full soundtrack wasn't in there, particularly in Vice City, they're going to get a backlash. And I mean, stuff like Michael Jackson's Billie Jean and Wannabe Starting Something's not in there, which to me, I hear Billie Jean and instantly I think of Vice City.
I think, I can't remember which one of you it was, but one of you said like, oh, 10 songs not on the definitive edition. And then literally, I think it was Dan, you said it, like 10 songs not on there. And then immediately Ravi was like, 40 songs not on there, mate. Yeah. Like straight away, like, you know, in our group chat, it was just like, oh my days. So I thought
there would be a few that didn't make it on, but not to that extent.
Sorry to go into it, but you know, one thing that we mentioned previously on the show was the hot coffee mod, which caused a lot of issues because they left that code in, a very naughty mod in there. And it's like they haven't done any quality control on this, because apparently the hot coffee mod code's still in this new version, which is, I just can't get my head around that. If you've gone through this huge court case about a kind of mod that you've had in there and a piece of content, then how are you going to... like remove it from the game and then in the re-release bring it back? I don't know.
Quality control here, man. Like, you just, I don't know. I just don't know what's happened. And it just baffles me that, like, you know, I was playing my Xbox. I just booted my Xbox earlier on to watch some TV on it, and it was on the main page, like, Grand Theft Auto Trilogy, $54.99. I'm like, you're having a laugh. Like, my days, you want 55 quid for this? And it's just like, you haven't even, like, have you even tested it? Do you know what I mean?
Now, I have played a bit of it, and I've got the Switch version. Okay. I got it on launch day. Unfortunately, I was away at the weekend. I'd like to have played it more before we record it. I played a bit of GTA 3. I've got to say, I mean, I did see some things wrong with it. There were a few, like, you know, texture popping, and it does kind of look like, and I've seen other people refer to it as this, it looks like everything's kind of smeared with Vaseline on the screen. It is quite blurry. I mean, I must admit, there is some kind of weird graphics and stuff as well. There's some of the characters are kind of, the way they've been remade look a bit odd. I didn't see any major problems with it, but I probably only played it for about five minutes.
That GTA 3 is the best out of
that. That's what I heard. I was about to say, out of the three, I've heard GTA 3 is the most playable one.
So, I mean, I'm looking forward to trying the other ones just to see. I mean, you know what it's like, though, often... I'm not saying, you know, they've done a good job with this. Obviously, there are some major problems with it, and there's not really an excuse for a PlayStation 2, an original Xbox game, not to run butter smooth on a modern console 20 years later. But you know what it's like, sometimes people kind of pile on. So I'll be interested to actually see, again, whether it is as bad as people have been making out when I try it, or whether they are. I mean, they've got to do a patch, surely. They can't leave these problems unfixed.
Yeah, interestingly, I heard that they'd kind of removed it off one of the stores because it had files that they didn't want in, intentionally unintentionally include a fart. I don't know if that was to do with the hot coffee, but also apparently there's an uncompiled version of like all the game kind of locations and stuff, which is really important for modders. So modders may actually be able to go back and kind of use that and improve mod stuff. So, and I've seen that there's been a lot of complaints about the rain as well, and apparently a mod's just come out that fixed that. So yeah, again, it's a modders to the rescue on this one.
Well, actually, I mean, you look at some of the mods of the original game. I mean, you know, fan kind of upscales and stuff look better than some of the stuff they've done in this game. So the fact that, I mean, I think they might have got people might have been a bit more lenient on them if it was like a, you know, maybe a £10 per game and you could buy them individually.
And I reckon they're probably going to get a team in now and they're going, this is such bad PR, we've got to make it good. And, you know, probably in a month with a couple of updates, it will be absolutely amazing. But, you know, it's bad to see this much of a dodgy launch. And I know there was issues with like GTA 4 and stuff before, but yeah, this is like it seems like a bit of a rush job and a bit of a money grab to me.
Yeah, it's already got that rep now as being terrible, which, you know, takes a lot of coming back from, I think, once it's out there, especially to this scale. So, I mean, I'm looking at this and I was honestly thinking the other day, I wouldn't mind playing a bit of Vice City again. I thought, oh, I'll just play it on my PS2.
Yeah. You
know, it's got the full soundtrack. I know the game's good on there.
We've all got it on our shelf as well. Like, yeah. Well, you're the idiot who bought the new one.
Yeah, I am. So I'll play a bit more and I'll give my verdict when I've got into it. Maybe they'll have patched it by then. Something I'm desperate to get my hands on and play, though, is something that I've got to say looks incredible. Now, Duke Nukem 3D, obviously one of the most, you know, legendary first-person shooters. This is a new version of it. I was going to say it's a mod, but actually it's like an entirely new game built around the engine called Duke Smoochum 3D that is really just a reflection on everyday life as a Brit, really, isn't it? Someone who lives in Britain will relate to this.
It's pretty much like our high street at the moment, but taken to the extremes, yeah.
I cracked up when I saw this. I had to send this to the guy straight away. So this comes from a guy called Dan Douglas. Now, I'm not too familiar with his background, but essentially what he did, from what I understand, is, you know, I won't go into the whole details of it, but our health secretary, Matt Hancock, had a scandal, as many British people will know, a few months ago, and he made a game where it was just a room using Duke Nukem, wasn't it, where you could, like, watch the scandal happen.
Using the build engine, which is by Ken Silverman, which Duke Nukem's based on. Yeah,
which went under our radar. I hadn't heard of that. I don't think you guys had heard of that. And essentially, because of the popularity of it, he's making it into a full game, and it's just got so much like British satire in it. And it was just so funny watching the 5-minute game trailer of it.
It's like playing Viz magazine or Spitting Image or something like that. It's all the textures are changed, so you're on the British high street. And
they all look the same these days. Every British high street's got the same to his local little Greggs.
And it's got like map lenses there, but it's, you know, caged off and closed because it's just shut down recently.
That made me sad.
It's got lots of politicians in as well. So I think Theresa May's in a field of wheat.
Yeah.
Dancing.
Yeah, you can visit Corbyn on an allotment. David Cameron's in his little...
We won't go into what he's doing with that thing.
Nigel Farage is in there. It's like completely absurd and just the maddest combination of everything. And you're running around with a Duke Nukem gun.
The bit that I loved, and Joe, he sent this over to me, and there's a bit where he's outside CEX and Mr. Blobby makes an appearance. I'm realizing that anyone outside the UK is like, what the hell are these guys talking
about? Yeah, that's why I tried to keep it as just like as simple as possible. It's so British, but... Yeah, man. If you're at all interested in it, like, go check it out. It's very funny. That's all.
I'm just watching a clip where he's blowing up Stonehenge.
Yeah,
with a load of dynamite.
I think what makes it really funny for me as well is they've kept all the original like Duke Nukem 3D like taglines and stuff. You know, like, so he's like, so it's still Duke Nukem. Like, you know, he's still like, yeah, baby, kind of thing. Like, why he's like blowing Mr. Blobby away and stuff like that. So no idea how you can get a hold of this game or if it is actually going to come out, you know, as a mod to be playable.
I've seen a couple of mods done on this engine before, and one relevant to the last story that I actually saw was GTA 1. So the original, you know, above view GTA, they did a full Duke Nukem 3D engine, like 3D version of that, and you could go around the city and I don't think the car really worked because it was just kind of Duke Nukem running around really fast, like pretending be a car. But that was pretty impressive to see on that engine. And also this engine, you can upgrade it to higher graphics as well. So you can do it in higher resolution. I think it's a Polymost. There's a Polymost kind of add-on. So it's amazing because this engine, if you look at the history of the build engine, it really started from the ground up and was developed by one guy and then went on to so many games like, William Shatner's Tech Wars, Shadow Warrior. Duke Nukem, Redneck Rampage as well was another one.
I love all those games. So I recently went on like a real kind of like playing Hexen and Doom and like Blood. So, you know, this is right up my alley if I could get a hold of it. But yeah, just the Britishness of it, you know, even, you know, some retro stuff in there, like the Batman standing on, I forget what building it is, you know, when there was that protest and everything like that. It's
The Fathers for Justice thing.
Yeah, it's hilarious to watch.
Yeah, so if you ever want to play Duke Nukem defending a London city sightseeing bus or blowing up a defunct BHS department store or gunning down Mr. Blobby outside CX, hopefully we'll be able to get to play this soon. I've got to say, I'm more excited about this game than I am about Grand Theft Auto 6, same. Actually. Looking at this. So hopefully it'll be available to play very soon. Something else that sounds amazing as well. Have you ever wanted, and I'm sure the answer to this is going to be a big yes, to play a retro arcade-style beat-em-up game as David Hasselhoff?
That's also right up my street. Like, this episode is just the embodiment of me. So, yeah, this comes from Hello There Games, which was a surprise release a couple of days ago. It's based on, I don't know if you guys have seen it, the short film Kung Fury, or heard of it at all?
Yes.
I saw that Hoff did the soundtrack, so he did like a video of one of the tunes.
Yes.
And it's the best proper cheesy 80s.
Yes, perfect.
Soundtrack.
I'm so glad you guys know it. So Kung Fury, the short film, came out six years ago? It's been a while. And I know it got funded for a full film release, which I'm pretty sure has been filmed. I could be completely wrong. It could have been out by now, but I know it was filmed. But I know there's been a few Kung Fury games, a few mobile games, and this is a Steam game, Kung Fury Street Rage, which has been out for a while on Steam, which I wasn't aware of. This is essentially like a Streets of Rage beat-em-up, but they did a patch for it, a chapter 2 for it the other day, and it is called A Day at the Beach. So essentially it's like a second level to the game where you're playing on a beach, but they've added David Hasselhoff as an additional character. And as Ravi said, he did the soundtrack to the film, to the short film, and there was a music video. And like Dan said, it was pure 80s cheese. I actually love that song. And they've also made it two player. The original game wasn't two player. So a really fun little expansion to the game, which just randomly came out with like kind of, you know, Kung Fury has been silent recently, as far as I know. I've not seen anything about it or anything like that. This is the only thing I've seen. So, you know, maybe they're just kind of putting that out there, just like the film's still coming. You know, we're still interested in this franchise. Don't worry, Joe, you know, it's coming. So, yeah, really cool. So if you want to play as David Hasselhoff beating up people Kung Fu style on the beach, this is your game.
I've got a feeling that making it a two-player game is going to cause some big arguments. Everyone wants to be the Hoff.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Surely. Like, I
want to be a young Hoff, not the drunken kebab eating off the floor Hoff.
I don't think that'd
include that though.
maybe the game ends up like that the further you get into
potentially.
Cool. Now, speaking of kind of famous franchises that have made it onto home systems, obviously a movie that's been massive recently, Dune, that film being, you know, I've seen everyone raving about that recently. And I remember the game. I didn't play it back in the day, but I remember reading reviews of the game. I think Virgin put it out, didn't they, back in the early 90s.
And it was very popular on the Amiga as well.
And the Mega CD, I think it was on as well, Dune, if I remember. And I remember getting some really good reviews back then. But it turns out there's actually a Dune game that was meant to be released on the Game Boy Advance that never made it around 20 years ago, that finally is getting a form of release.
I think it looks pretty good for a Game Boy Advance game. So from what I understand, the game was cancelled in 2002. No idea why.
But financial issues.
There we go. But it's recently been bought by the Retro Room Games, who have bought the engine, but they don't have the IP rights to Dune, which, you know, is like a huge multi-million dollar film now, you know, like the remake and everything, well, re-release or whatever you want to call it. So they're rebranding the game, which I'll get onto in a second, and, you know, release. But essentially, by the looks of things, the original game, now I don't want to try and pretend that I know about Dune, like I'm like a fake nerd right now. I don't know Dune. I've not seen the film. I've not read the books. But by the looks of things, it's a first-person space shooter, and you fly around in the deserts, you know, in a flying craft, you know, fighting other people. Graphically, it looks pretty impressive for a Game Boy Advance game. You know, like, I wouldn't say it's like PS1 graphics or anything like that, but, you know, it looks pretty good.
Yeah,
it
looks like
it runs quite well.
3D voxel engine, and also then you're getting, like, people talking over it as well. You've kind of got these, like, freeze frames, and then, you know, their mouths are moving and stuff. But it does look very interactive and very far away from the kind of Dune games on the Amiga where it's all command and conquer style strategy stuff. This is more like a X-Wing or something like that, a Star Fox style.
Yeah, Colony Wars, Star Fox, like you say, X-Wing. And, you know, it's coming out now. It's being released as, is it Elend the Crystal Wars?
Which is interesting because, yeah, in the game is called Ellen.
Yeah.
And Ravi spotted this because there is actually a football stadium. Leeds Football Club play in at Elland Road.
Okay.
That's Egrand, isn't it? But there's also mention of Trafford in here as well, which is obviously Man United.
Yeah, and the enemies are like Trafford Corporation. And you've kind of got to fight them. So I think basically there's a neighbouring world in there called Mank as well.
Oh, okay.
So I think they've basically ripped any reference from Dune out of there and replaced it with like football kind of banter and terms, you know.
I think that's the best thing they could have done with it, really. Do you know what I mean? And they're doing it currently as a Kickstarter, with their goal being £10,000, I believe. The point of recording this, they're just over £3,000, but it has just started, I think, literally like yesterday. So it'll be a couple of days in the point of release.
Yeah, they only want 5,000 actually, 5,632.
Oh, is it? Oh, I'm wrong. My bad. So yeah, they only want 5,632. There we go. But yeah, it looks so, you know, they're going to be releasing it on the GBA. And if I think if they hit the right goals and stuff like that, they're going to be doing a physical release, which, you know, we always love. But yeah, definitely some big footy fans there.
Even though the game has nothing to do with football, it's like,
yeah. We had some confusion, didn't we, before we recorded, because like Ravi was like, oh, it's a football game, and I was like, no, it's not.
Neither of us have been into football, you or me, James.
Yeah, so like, absolutely no idea what he was on about, so I'm glad Ravi spotted it.
But it is good though, because I mean, what they've really done then is, I mean, it looked like this game was pretty much finished back in 2002, so they've got the game, and like you said, they're getting rid of all the Dune references. Obviously, I imagine getting that franchise, particularly now, is very expensive, but it looks like otherwise it was a pretty much finished game. They're just kind of tweaking a little bit, and it's going to be a commercial, pretty much a AAA quality game that would have come out back in 2002.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like Dan says, you know, it's like, oh, it's coming out at the same time as the film, so they can't get a hold of the IP at all. But I wonder if they've kind of done that on purpose for the story behind it as well, because on the Kickstarter, they do make a point of like, you know, this was the Dune game, so... You know, maybe it'll tap into some of the fans there as well, but we'll see.
That's quite clever, actually. If so, and I think graphically as well. I mean, I always, you know, I kind of equate, and you know, you're more of a Game Boy fan than I am, Joe. I always had the Game Boy Advance down as like a handheld Super Nintendo, really. So graphically, I think it's quite impressive.
Yeah,
you know,
and I always saw it as like handheld Super Nintendo. Even growing up, it was always like, oh, it's like the SNES. And then when the DS came out, I always saw that as like it could play N64 games, essentially. That's how I kind of felt about it, as you know, as a teenager. Yep. So it is always nice when you see these like first person shooters, you know, that's the only way I can kind of describe it, coming out on the Game Boy Advance. And there is a good handful of them out there. Some of them are very choppy, but you know, this one looks pretty good, so I want to give it.
Yeah, it looks really smooth.
Yeah, so this is Elend the Crystal Wars. It is running on Kickstarter right now if you want to back it. I think it doesn't finish until middle of January next year, actually. It's got a bit of time. And of course, I'll link that up and everything else we talked about in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into our chat this week, talking about classic games like Agony, Unreal, Outcast with our guest, Frank Sauer. He's coming up in just a moment. Let's give a thank you to another big supporter of the Retro Hour podcast. And this is our friends at Monster Joysticks. Now, listen to this. Doesn't that sound nice?
Is that the beautiful sound of micro switches I hear?
It is. Ooh. Proper Sanwar arcade parts.
Lovely jubbly.
Well, this is what it Monster Joysticks. I mean, if you're not familiar with them, they offer a wide range of quality arcade joysticks. And actually, they do a few different versions as well. They've got retro gaming joystick kits that work with everything, like classic computers like the Amiga, the Atari ST, the Commodore 64, the Spectrum. They even do versions for consoles as well, like the Mega Drive, the Amiga CD32, the PC Engine. And they also do what I've got here, an all-in-one 9-button Raspberry Pi arcade stick, where actually, if I look around the back of this nice substantial joystick, you know, it's got the 6 buttons on the top there, got a start button as well, coin insert, you know, proper arcade parts as well. It actually feels like playing an arcade machine when I've got it hooked up to the TV. But the really cool thing is you turn it round and in the back, there's a little Raspberry Pi embedded in there that I've put in there with an SD card, main boot straight up, plug it into my, actually, you know, the Raspberry Pi I've got in here is Raspberry Pi 3 with the composite output. So I can hook this up to a CRT TV.
Oh, nice.
And it feels like a mini arcade machine. It's incredible. So it gives you that real portable arcade experience. I know you've got one as well, Ravi, one of the Amiga joysticks, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I've got the CD32 joystick and... You know, it's got...
Give it a click.
Oh, here we go. It's the AMSR hour. Like, some people said that after last week with the tapes. Yeah, it's got a button at the back where you can basically change the up to jump to a button, which is really awesome to do. And also, it's just fun putting it together because it only requires a screwdriver, but I didn't have to solder anything, so I didn't end up ruining anything, you know. It's really nice little joystick and actually... find it the best one that I've used on my Amiga.
Yeah, I love the quality parts that are in here as well. Like you said, you know, the fact that you and I can put this together, you know, we didn't have to solder it or anything, says a lot, I think. So, and there are versions with genuine Sanwar arcade parts and more budget-friendly arcade part options as well. So why don't you check them out and support the podcast? Obviously, Christmas coming up, you know, if it's getting to that time of year when your friends and family, your other half is asking, you know, what do you want for Christmas? These make really good presents, actually very affordable too. So you can find them right now and support the podcast by checking them out at monsterjoysticks.com. Now, before we jump into our interview, just time to give a big mention to be honest, the lifeblood of this podcast. And that is our wonderful patrons who, to be quite honest, without our patrons, you know, particularly over the last 18 months or so, this podcast probably wouldn't be here.
Yeah, basically, without our patrons, we would be on cassette tape and would have to deliver it to bike to each of us. No, you guys have...
that sounds quite appealing, actually.
Yeah, quite retro. You guys have actually enabled us to get studios, which is just amazing. You know, we can record from home, keep the quality up of the show and get some fantastic guests. And backing us as well, you get like a ad-free episode, which is awesome. And it's for a really reasonable price. But also, you get to hear our inner thoughts and kind of stories of the past and... our thoughts about other topics with the backstage section, which is the retro hour after hours. And you also get to meet us on the Patreon hangout and we all chat in this massive kind of group. And it's like a pub or a computer club. And man, it's good, but it's dangerous because we end up kind of all recommending each other bits of equipment. And, you know, the wallets kind of get a bit lighter. But you guys are fantastic because you have helped us keep independent and looking at the charts, you know, there's so many podcasts out there that have backing from huge organizations and we're pretty much free people. And, you know, without your support, we wouldn't be going.
And it is humbling because often, Ravi, you keep an eye on the podcast charts every week and we're up there with, like, you know, Wired Magazine and the BBC.
IGN.
Sometimes the top 10. Yeah, sometimes the top 10, we're the only independent podcast in there. So... you know, without the support of our patrons, that wouldn't be the case. So we'd really appreciate that. And like Ravi said, I mean, you get the normal podcast early most weeks. You get it ad-free as well. You get extra patrons, exclusive content in there as well, an extra news story or two each week. And also you get our patrons exclusive podcast once a month, the Retro Hour After Hours, a new episode of which will be landing next week, all about the Sega Dreamcast. And we're going to be doing our monthly patrons hangout this coming Sunday at 8 p.m, which is always so much fun and, as you said, quite expensive. I think you spend most of the hangout on eBay, Joe?
Yeah, eBay and CEX. Because some people just come on and they're just like, oh, yeah, this week I've bought this, and this. And I'm like, oh, my God, I need to look at these videos now. I need it. So, yeah, I usually get, as Ravi says, a lighter wallet around Sunday night.
So if you'd like to help us out on Patreon, a minute is getting to the time of the year where it's going to be our 6th birthday, which is nuts, in January. That doesn't mean stuff like our website hosting and audio, all of that, all those costs come up again. And obviously our Patreon, we put it all back into that. So, you know, you're helping out the show as well to keep it going each Friday. So if you'd like to back us on Patreon, all the details are at theretrohour.com, and we will give you a massive shout in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And let's give a big welcome and a big thank you to some of our newest patrons, including Niccolo Pitoni,
Christopher Tuckwell,
Philippe Gomes,
Antti Laihavainen,
and Action Retro, who we're actually having on the podcast soon.
Yes, we are. Thank you very much for your support. And everybody else as well, if you'd like to back us on Patreon, as I mentioned, all the details are on our website. You'll find it on the front page of theretrohour.com. Right, then next, it is going to be the guest on this week's show, the bit that we look forward to, chatting about some incredible games. Honestly, like I said before, you know, Agony, just a life-changing game for me as a kid. So can't wait to get the inside story on that and lots more as well with our special guest, Frank Sauer. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. Now, I've been particularly hyped to speak to our guest this week, who was behind. He actually worked on one of the games that convinced me to get an Amiga back in the day, Agony. What an incredible game. We'll talk more about that soon. And of course, artist for other games like Iron Lord, Unreal, Outcast, the co-founder of developer Art Magic as well. Let's welcome on our very special guest this week, the amazing Frank Sauer. How are you doing, Frank?
Hey, guys. I'm fine, thank you. And you?
Yeah, very good, thank you. And really appreciate you coming on to share some stories about those classic titles as well. We always like to kind of go back to day one with our guests as well and kind of find out what originally got you into gaming. I mean, do you remember what was your earliest video gaming memory then? Where did it all begin?
Yeah, I think it was Space Invaders, basically, in an arcade near my village. And I was really hooked by the ability of a machine to display images, moving images, and produce sound that just blew me away. And actually, later on, I found out that game was ported to several microcomputers, and that's how I got into microcomputers, thanks to Space Invaders, yeah.
What was the computing and gaming scene like then when you were growing up in Belgium, and what were kind of the main machines that, you know, your friends had?
During the 8-bit era, I would say that the Commodore 64 was the main machine. But I was at a computer club near my town, and I met with many friends, including my future partner, Yves Goret, who worked with me on building the companies. And all the guys at the computer club had various machines, some very obscure, even one Belgian machine. I don't know if you know about it, the Die. Which was a very advanced computer for the time. There were all sorts of machines, but he and I shared the same Commodore machine, and that's how we started working on the machine. I also had, before that, a Texas Instrument TI-99/4A, and you know, Belgium is a small country. It's a middle in the middle of in between larger countries. So I think we had various machines because of various influences from our neighbors. But mainly, I would say that the Commodore 64 was the most popular 8-bit machine.
I'm quite interested in that machine you mentioned from Belgium as well. Did you say it was the Die? What was that like then? I've never heard of that before.
It was built as a business computer, but it had very advanced graphic capabilities for the time, capable of drawing images in 512 by 280-something. So it was quite expensive. And I remember one guy at the club, at the computer club, at one of those machines. I tried to buy one on eBay a few years ago, but the price was much too high. very, very collector machines nowadays.
Well, you mentioned that your first machine was the Texas Instruments TI-99 4A. And what kind of stuff were you doing on there, and how practical was that machine?
Well, that's the machine I learned the basic programming language on. So my first programs, I remember coming back from the store with the machine, and my mom helped me reading the manual and starting writing the first commands. And soon she gave up because I was much too fast for her. And the first thing I noticed was that you could create your own graphics. The basic didn't provide access to the frame buffer, or I don't even think it had a full frame buffer. But you could modify the character set and create some graphics out of redefined characters, what we would call later tile-based graphics. And all that had to be done by hand. So you had to, I would draw pixels on a sheet of paper and then transcribe those into hexadecimal values for each line of each character. And that took pages and pages of basic code just to display a few characters on the screen. But it was such an incredible experience to produce your own images on the screen. The TI Basic also provided some functions to call sound routines. It had a very basic sound chipset. I don't remember the chipset exactly, but it was something like 3 square waves and 1 noise wave and something like that. And you could call in Basic a routine to play a note at a certain pitch with a certain duration, and I would try to play some tunes using that. There were no tools, so it was all programming directly using the various basic instructions. The basic was pretty basic. And I learned that you could write programs in assembly language, but unfortunately, I didn't know that at the time, but I learned that years later, that Texas Instruments provided a workstation to make their own games in assembly language, which were very expensive, so not many developers were using those. Later on, they provided a cartridge with a small assembler, but I was already moving away from that machine, and I think that's part of the reason why the TI didn't succeed that much as compared to more open platforms like the C64, for instance.
Well, moving on to the C64, you worked with your classmates at night, and you created a game, No Never Outside, which was a graphical adventure for the C64, and it took 3 years. So what was the kind of aims, and what was it like working on a big project, collaborating?
I think the main goal was just to make something happen, to create our own game, our own universe, and hopefully, you know, sell many of them and become famous. I think we sold like something like 400 pieces in total. But at least it gave us the opportunity to enter the games industry, the nascent game industry. So it was a very long process because we worked, as you said, only in the evening at night, and there were no internet, of course, at the time. So we had to meet either at our places or at the computer club. My mom had to drive me to his place because I didn't have a driving license yet. So it was very complicated, and very slow process. But we managed to finish it. It's something that I learned maybe at that moment, that in the games industry, the main thing is to finish something. Even if it's not very good, finishing a project is very, very important. It gives you the makes you understand the difficulties, the makes you understand that you really need to continue endlessly working on your thing. And I think that's why there's a lot of people trying to get into the games industry, but they give up because they cannot stand the pressure and the work that has to be done to finish a game. That's very important.
I mean, obviously doing a graphical adventure for your first title, you know, very ambitious. And graphically, I mean, it's a beautiful game on the C64. And I was reading that actually you did quite a lot of those graphics on an SX64, which for people that don't know, was a portable version of the Commodore 64. Now, I say portable, it's not like a MacBook Air. This thing was 10.5 kilograms, yeah. A carry handle, a little 5-inch CRT screen in there as well. I mean, it must have been difficult doing art on such a tiny screen.
Actually, I had two screens. I had a monochrome larger screen that was hooked up to the SX64. So I would check the color on the small screen and I would check the pixel quality, if I can say so, on the larger screen. And there's some mistakes in the colors if you look at some of the pictures, because I mismatched the choice of color, because they were looking okay on the monochrome monitor, but they were not quite at the right place. And there was no the tool was very primitive too, so that there was no zoom that you could paint into. So if I recall well, there was a small window that showed what you were painting in a zoom fashion, an enlarged view, but you couldn't paint in that enlarged view. So the precision was really, really bad. And it was all jittery because the converters of the XY position of the tablet were really noisy. That was terrible, terrible. I still have the tablet, by the way, and the SX64 too.
Oh, nice. You got it published by Lancor. Who were those guys? And
they were a French publisher in Paris, and they had published various games mainly on other platforms, like the Atari ST and the Amiga. They were, although we were at the very end of the life of the C64, they were eager to have also some games on that platform, and for us that. It was, again, the opportunity to enter the very closed games industry. Having published something opens a lot of doors, and that really was our goal.
Well, how popular was the Amstrad CPC in France? Because I know you did some games on there. I mean, tell us about the titles that you worked on the Amstrad, and were there many other opportunities in that world?
Actually, the game I worked on the Amstrad was when I was employee at Ubisoft. They were also working with independent programmers, and there was that guy who had made a game on the Amstrad. The game was called Terre and Conquerant, which is like a kind of Command and Conquer game, and he didn't know how to do the graphics. So he asked his publisher, which was Ubisoft, can you make the graphics for us, for me? And as I was an employee and I had already some experience on the 8-bit platforms, and I was eager to try to work on that machine because it had a larger palette than the C64. The colors were more vibrant, maybe a bit too vibrant. And so it was interesting to work on that platform. But I didn't see the result of the game, of the graphics integrated into the game, until many years later when I bought a copy of the game on eBay. So that was a very bizarre process, working on some graphics based on specification, sending the graphics over, and didn't hear about the game until years later.
Well, tell us about working with Ubisoft then. I mean, they were all based in like a giant castle at the time then. What was kind of the atmosphere and the culture like there at that time?
It was very unprofessional. it was fun. It was fun because we were a bunch of nerds locked in a castle in the middle of nowhere, and we were left on our own, literally. So the time started to shift. We were waking up at noon, having fun during the day and programming at night. And that was really, really a very unique experience. And the castle was in the middle of a large forest, several square kilometers. So you couldn't walk out of the forest. It was too big. So we were literally on our own, and Ubisoft provided food. So there were suppliers coming every day or every week. with food and drinks and so on. And the rest of the time, it was just like, do whatever you like. No planification, no nothing. And surprisingly, a couple of games came out of that experience. And we met a lot of really cool people who happened to develop a very important expertise in their field and share some important information during that time. So it was nice.
I hear you tried to trick one of your bosses into thinking you'd developed artificial intelligence.
Yeah. That was Gérard, one of the youngest Guillemot brother. What we did was that we had a couple of developers working on Amigas, and we set up one Amiga in one of the room and another one in another room, and we connect them together using, I think, some serial cable that was going out the window from one room to the other. And then we invited Gérard to talk to the computer, because we had downloaded from some obscure BBS an artificial intelligence or something like that. And we told him, you can ask any question, personal question, and it will answer. And what we had was a simple text connection between the two machines. And while the guy on the other room was typing the answer, we would have the disk drive LED blinking, like if the machine was thinking about the answer. And we had his girlfriend with us on the other room. So we started to tell very intimate things about his life. He was going crazy. What the hell is happening here? Yeah, that was fun.
Well, another really ambitious game that you worked on the Commodore 64 was Iron Lord. I know originally that was a Atari ST.
Yeah.
Role-playing game, and that, you know, loads of mini games and stuff in there as well. It, you know, quite a complicated game. How did you handle the Commodore 64 conversion while keeping all those mini games and the graphics high quality? Because I mean, obviously going from 16-bit to 8-bit, you know, quite a downgrade usually.
Yeah, everything had to be rewritten from scratch. So nothing except the end result. We had a goal to fulfill, to try to be as faithful as possible to the original, but we couldn't share anything from the original game, except maybe some texts or something. But so all the graphics had to be done from scratch. And if you look at the graphics, they aren't exactly the same. It's a rewrite reinterpretation of the original by the three artists that we were working on the title. So three artists for 164 game is very ambitious indeed. And probably unheard of at the time. Yeah, it was a lot of work. And the fact that it was written in assembly language made it possible, because the original, I think, was a mixture of GFA basic probably and some assembly for some routines. But so the original game was taking a lot more space because of the way it was implemented. The assembly implementation of C64 was more compact, more tight, and worked better on that front. It was to the point that our version came out before the original, because they still had some bugs on the original because of the basic and the memory leaks. And
it had a great music as well, where Jerome Tell created the soundtrack. What was it like working with him?
I don't remember who contacted Maniacs of Noise, but the fact is that we knew them from the demo scene. When we were at the castle, we often downloaded some demos from BBS, and one of the demos that I really was fond of was from Scoop Designs. It was That's the Way It Is, and I think it was Jeroen who wrote that tune, and it just blew me away the way that they were capable of producing such sounds out of this little chip. And so Ubisoft contacted them, and I think they work on several games. And we kept in contact with Jeroen, and that's how we came to have him on board for the Amiga games as well.
Let's talk about your work on the Amiga. What was it like when you started using that platform, and kind of what packages were you using, and what tricks did you learn early on to really push that machine graphically?
Well, the first thing I have to say about the Amiga is that I was both disappointed and amazed by the machine when it came out. I was a bit disappointed by the sound originally, because I was expecting Commodore to come up with some advanced synthesizer, and it was just for audio sampling voices, and I saw that as a downgrade from coming from the subtractive synthesizer that was a SID on the C64. But later on, programmers started to implement their own synthesizer using software-based synthesis. So some great tools happened later on during the life of the Amiga. But on the graphic side, it was really an amazing platform. I remember seeing the one of the first Amiga here in Belgium playing the Juggler demo, yeah. Retracing, even if it was just a flip book of pre-rendered images, the fact that you could create such images using ray tracing at home was just mind-blowing. So I have always been interested in computer graphics, and I think I was interested in computer graphics even more than in games at the beginning. It just happened that if you wanted to create graphics, you had to have a computer, and you could also do games. And that's how I started in the game industry and making my first game because of the platform. But originally, I wanted to do computer graphics. So when the Amiga came out, I was like, wow, I can use some 3D modeling tools. And so I started playing with those. And I used 3D graphics in some of the games as pre-rendered sprites. But mostly for the games, I used, obviously, Deluxe Paint. I think it was Deluxe Paint 3, the most popular one that I used for most of the games. I was expecting a little bit more in terms of interfaces, because I've seen in professional workstation they were using graphics tablets, but there were no graphics tablets on the Amiga, so I had to learn back how to use a mouse to do the graphics. Fortunately, it was mostly pixel art, so it was mostly placing one pixel at a time, so you didn't really have to have free-form movements, you know, to create shapes. You would create shapes by placing pixels. So the mouse was okay. I learned to use that input device.
Well, your first title, Unreal, on the Amiga, was absolutely stunning. And you had lots of, like, 3D assets as well as 2D. Mm-hmm. Was that a lot of work to do, those 3D sections as well as the 2D ones?
In terms of programming, it was two games in one. So that's how we split the work. We were four working on that game, and we say, okay, we want to make a graphic adventure with a action graphic adventure with 3D elements in it, because we were fans of some of the arcade games with scaling sprites. I think that was really the moment when we started thinking about what 3D is, and the fact that 3D was the ultimate goal for any game developer, something that seems absolutely obvious today. But when you live in a 2D world, you don't necessarily think further until you start experimenting with different play fields, different distance and scaling, and then suddenly you realize, but I need to get immersed in this environment, so I need 3D. And obviously those machines weren't able to do a proper 3D with textured graphics and such. So the only way to provide in some kind of 3D was to use scaled sprites. So Eve worked on the 3D part and worked on the routines to scale the sprites. And Jan worked on the 2D part. And we, Mark Albine, who's been working at Ubisoft recently, worked with me on various levels. Some of the assets, although they are sprites or more like blitter object actually, were pre-rendered using some of the 3D tools that I been experimenting on the Amiga. So I wanted to try new methods of rendering, pre-rendering sprites, not just drawing them all by hand, especially when I wanted to have some kind of 3D movement, like the floating castle in one of the latest level of the game. It was modeled in 3D with some crude shapes, and then overpaint. Each frame was overpainted in Deluxe Paint to give more detail and more texture.
Well, obviously Unreal, I mean, it was a stunning game, and Ubisoft published it, but you went independent. I mean, was that the start of Art and Magic coming together then? What was kind of the story there?
Yeah, we were working on Iron Lord and other internal projects as employees. During the night, we would work at home on a new project, and that was the beginning of Unreal. And at some point, we pitched the game to the Ubisoft guys, but we told them, okay, we cannot continue working as employees on your internal games and work on our own project. We need to quit the regular job, and of course they agree. Looking back at it, it's more it's obvious that it's financially more interesting for them to pay independence only when they provide some milestones for the games instead of paying employees whatever they do.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But we came back in Belgium and worked on the game, and we had a deal for a publishing deal. We did not sell that much. I mean, it was okay, given that the Amiga was already nearing its end of life. But it was again another stepstone for us to get more visibility in the industry. Indeed, that's how we got our contract with Psygnosis later on.
Well, how did the industry react then? Because I saw a lot of people would put it up against Shadow of the Beast, and they would do, like, you know, a real versus Shadow of the Beast kind of comparison.
Well, I think it was far from being up to the Shadow of the Beast standard. But the thing is that for a French publisher, it was one of their flagship products, especially on that platform, because it was a very technical game. And the game was nominated for some awards. I don't think we got awards. Maybe one. I don't remember. But yeah, it was well received by the public, especially in France, because it was coming from a French publisher.
Let's talk about Agony. And I remember, you know, as a kid, just before I got my Amiga, going to a friend's house and actually seeing his Amiga 500 with Agony on there. And I saw the intro screen and that incredible parallax effects on there as well. So tell us a story of Agony and how some of those effects were implemented, and how did you get to work on them?
Originally, we planned to do a sequel to Unreal, and we wanted to have a futuristic shoot 'em up game. And the thing is that one of our programmers, Jan, had to go to do his military duty. So our team was shrinking, and so we thought, okay, let's not go into too complicated development. Let's not make another action adventure. We thought at the time that the shoot 'em up was smaller, more constrained, so it was easier to develop. On the other hand, we also were looking at the production from Psygnosis, and we were fans of their work. I mean, all the studios that were signed by Psygnosis were doing incredible work. You talked about Shadow of the Beast, but there were many others. And so we thought, okay, let's make a demo. Let's show them a demo during the CTS in London. And that's how it started. That's how we convinced them we're able to produce the kind of quality game that they were expecting from Psygnosis. So we met Steve Riding, one of the producer there. We showed him the demo. We showed him the demo at the Ubisoft booth because we were showing Unreal at the same time. And in the evening we went out for dinner with him, and he gave us a bunch of goodies from Psygnosis, t-shirts, books, art stuff, games, and we were just happy as could be. And a few days later, we signed the publishing deal with them.
Well, the main character, I mean, really stood out, you know, being an owl.
Yeah.
Is that because of Psygnosis and their logo, or was that an idea that you already had? And were there any other ideas for what the main character would be before the owl?
Originally, I think it was planned to make a spaceship, but then we thought, okay, all the shoot 'em ups are based on futuristic settings already. So what could we do to be a little bit original? And we thought about the fantasy setting, and I had this this video of the Labyrinth movie, and I thought, well, why not use a howl as the main character? It would be cool and appealing to the Psygnosis guys because that's their logo. But that was not their idea. We had the demo already with the whole animation, and that's maybe it helped signing the deal. But
a nice coincidence.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, how important was the Unreal Editor that you created before? Because like the graphics in that game are absolutely beautiful, and you know, even the intro screens and the holding slides and stuff are just fabulous. So how much did that help kind of speed up stuff?
The tool were pretty basic, actually. Eve wrote the tools, the various editing tools in GFA Basic. We had different tools depending on the game. On Unreal, it was not tile-based. It was only sprite-based. But the sprite would build a screen in advance, a three screen-wide map, if you will. Then that took like half a second to build at the beginning of a level. And then the screen would scroll when the character was moving. In Agony, we used a tiles-based system. Tiles were actual Blitter objects. It was not a limitation or a constraint coming from the hardware. It was a software tile-based system that we implemented with two layers that we could superimpose to enrich the environment. And then the parallax effect was made by using different tiles, using different graphical modes. So we had less and less color the more the further you get in depth. So the first playfield would have more color, then the next a little bit less, and the last playfield would only be one color. But with the Amiga, you had the ability to change dynamically the palette during the screen scanning. So the copper was a specialized chip that you could program to read a list of command and change register during the scanning of the screen. So you could change the background color, for instance, or the sprite color as you go. And that's a usual technique back then, even back to the Atari days, where you didn't have the memory to hold the frame buffer. Everything would be drawn as the screen displays the pixels. And in a sense, the Amiga was capable of both. It could handle a frame buffer, it could handle sprites, but it could also do the racing the beam kind of screen manipulation and color manipulation. So it was very tricky, but that's how most of the technically advanced games on the Amiga were working anyways.
Well, I mentioned before how, you know, Agony, that graphically left, you know, a huge impression on me as a kid. You know, not only the parallax scrolling, the rain and the lightning effects as well, but even from the very first screen. And I know that Roger Dean did the logo to that game as well. Obviously, yeah, you know, famous for doing a lot of rock album covers before that. And he did, you know, quite a few games logos for Psygnosis as well before that. I mean, that must have been amazing having him working on the game. And did that kind of give it some credibility and help it become a brand, Agony?
Yeah, probably. Although we never met him, it was just a work for error Psygnosis side. But Psygnosis had this ability to put together top resources, whether from music, from graphics, as you said, the design of the logo or the painting for the box art or whatever. They always hired the best people. And that's something that really was attractive to us. And we were really proud to be part of that family, if you will. So, yeah, I think definitely they had some branding attached to their package. The box design was really classy with a red stripe and around the black background. It was really, really nice. And they had sometimes you could find T-shirts inside the boxes and stuff like that. So really, really, really nice publisher all around. It's probably one time when we had a lot of artistic freedom. Of course, the game is not very advanced gameplay wise. There's nothing new or special about it. And maybe we could have invested more effort into the gameplay and maybe a little bit less on the technology. But those were the days.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, just putting that disc in, I would show it to friends just to be like, look what this machine can do.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, as a technical demo, it was incredible. And, you know, not just visually as well, I mean, the music in there, that, you know, that piano intro that Tim Wright did, I mean, that still gives me goosebumps to this day, that music. I mean, how did that kind of come into it? And what was it like working alongside Tim? You know, it really gave it a feel of quality, I think.
Yeah. What we wanted was to provide something different from the usual games, and I had this idea of a piano introduction music. I was playing a little bit of piano myself, and I quickly sketched a melody and sent it to Steve and said, could you hire some musician to do something like that for our intro, that it would be really classy and different from the techno kind of music that you usually hear with the I Shoot 'Em Up. And that's how we came to hire Tim Wright. And Tim sent over his music, but he was using pretty poor samples because he was very, my guess is he was very tight in memory when working on other titles. So he was used to produce very small samples. And I had a bunch of pretty good piano samples. So I replaced those. One of the sound, because the sampling rate I used was higher than the one he used. So one of the notes could not be played because the pitch range that the Amiga was capable of shifting the note was limited. And since my bass sample rate was already high, it couldn't reach that note. So I just took that note and moved it down one octave lower. So the music changed. At first, Tim was a bit, Not upset, but he felt strange because it didn't sound like the music he made. But we had all the right to do that because that's the way the contract worked. And in the end, I think it was a good choice because the people wouldn't know that one note was at the wrong of the octave. It was just a nice music, and that's how it's remembered, and that's cool.
Well, as you mentioned before, the kind of Amiga scene was dying off, and you guys at Art and Magic decided to go into arcades, and you ended up meeting up with Konami and decided on creating custom arcade boards. And I looked at these, and I'm quite interested because there was a bit of Amiga influence in there.
Absolutely.
What were the kind of elements that you had on those boards?
Our first thought was to go and see an arcade publisher, and we went at Konami headquarters in Germany. We met with them, and then they showed us their hardware. And when we came back, we thought, no, that's not the way we want to go. Their hardware was tile-based. It was a very old-school approach. And coming from the Amiga, we knew that the future was, you know, more software-driven, acceleration, hardware acceleration based on the Blitter, which eventually would become the modern GPU. The Blitter is the first 2D programmable accelerator, and today's 3D rasterizer are based on the pretty much the same principles. They fetch some texture from memory. They resample it. That's the new part. But at the time, they just took pixel as they were in memory and moved them in another part of the memory in the frame buffer. And that's what we wanted to do. And we wanted to do that very fast. At first, we thought about putting several Amiga mainboards together and composite the result to produce a final image. And when we met with the electronic company here in Belgium, they said, "Oh no, you can't do that. You're gonna run into a legal problem using the hardware from someone else." We were too young to think about those issues. And they said, "We can build a custom chip based on your specification." So we provided them with the basic specification. They built some prototype, and we iterate doing tests and came up finally with a very good 2D hardware with a custom blitter that was capable, if I remember correctly, of pushing 20 megapixels per second, which was pretty good for the time.
Well, speaking of other, you know, big titles that you worked on, I mean, skipping forward a few years to the end of the 90s, you were the director on Outcast, which was, you know, a groundbreaking action-adventure game. A lot of people described it at the time as being very ahead of its time. I mean, what kind of elements were in there that really pushed the boundaries, do you think?
I think the fact that it was one of the first truly open world game. Open world not just in the sense of the 3D space that you can explore, but also gameplay-wise, because you could literally progress in any direction. And there were some meet points in the scenario of the game, of course, but you could do whatever you like in any order that you liked in between those main points, which was really new at the time. Most of the games were very linear in their development. So not only we had a very unique rendering technique with the voxels landscape, not only the map were quite big for the time, there was this gameplay element that you were part of the story, but you could really decide the order of the events within the story. I think that's the main reason that the game is regarded as some unique and some milestone in the games industry. So funny enough, the game started as an ID for the arcade. So when we were, after we made several arcade games with our 2D board, we started thinking about creating a 3D board, but not based on polygon, based on voxels. And we even wrote some specification, but at the end, the hardware guys told us that's too early. The memory is too costly. We don't have the bandwidth. We don't have the compression methods, etc. So we dropped the ID, and instead we moved back to the consumer market through the PC platform because it was we saw the CPU as a way to better express ourselves because it was a programmable platform. We were not constrained by specific hardware features, and we could write our own renderer the way we liked. And that's how Outcast came to life.
Well, no, the game got a remake a few years ago, mm-hmm. as well, Outcast Second Contact. What was the idea of kind of bringing that game back, you know, after so long then, and how well was that received?
The idea was to produce a modern game with very little resources. And to be able to demonstrate our ability to produce decent quality titles on modern platforms and revive potentially the Outcast universe. And so we started with a crowdfunding campaign. We were aiming for 600,000 euros, which is not much for such a development. And it didn't work. It didn't work for several reasons. We weren't prepared enough, I think, for the campaign. But the good thing is that it raised the awareness around our project, and one publisher got interested into funding the game. So yeah, the game happened. It sold reasonably well. And the thing is that it served us as a new demo to try to get some new contracts. And we were fortunate enough to meet THQ Nordic at the Gamescom, and they were great fans of Outcast, and they signed Outcast 2 with us. So it's been announced, I think, last month or a few weeks ago. That Outcast 2 has now been in development for several years. I can't say anything about the release date. It's not announced yet, but it's happening.
the announcement trailer's out there. People can watch that. I'll link that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it will be out for the PC, PlayStation 5, and Xbox Series.
And I've seen so many people online, you know, really hyped that it's finally getting a full, proper sequel as well. So the fans must be over the moon about it. They must be really happy.
And it's looking quite good. The company has got some other development also at the moment that I can't talk about. Although personally, I've worked on Outcast 2 for about a year and a half. But since then, I've quit the production because that was too much stuff for me. And I wanted to go back to some personal project that I've been working on for a long time. Also, I teach at the university college here, so it was like two full-time jobs. That was too much.
Yeah, I bet. Well, it's great that you did do some work on it as well, though, and obviously we'll keep an eye on that game for when it comes out, and any other projects that you've got as well, Frank, we wish you all the best of luck with it, and thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your memories. It's been amazing to
talk
to you.
Thank you.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.